We are at Vanderbilt University. We're in Wilson Hall, which is the Department of Psychology, and we're with Tom Palmieri, who's a cognitive scientist here, director of graduate studies, and a member of the Temple Dynamics of Learning Center, the NSF-funded center of which I'm also a member. So why don't we begin with at least the temporal dynamics issue? If somebody goes to your website and looks to see what you do with the wonders of technology, let me do it. It says, we are particularly interested in the temporal dynamics of visual object recognition. So obviously this fits in. Could you give me some sense of how all this fits into the whole notion of timing, temporal dynamics, and so on?
Well, it fits in a number of ways. So one thing we're interested in is how the temporal dynamics change as people learn. So one of the things that's well known about experts, for example, in a domain, and suppose somebody's a radiologist or somebody's an ornithologist or has skills that really involve making very rapid perceptual decisions. One of the things we know is that people can make very fine-grained discriminations rapidly and accurately. And one of the things we're interested in is how the dynamics of those perceptual decisions change as people learn. So what happens as people shift from the kinds of more effortful decisions that we make as novices in the domain to the kind of rapid, automatic decisions that people make as experts? So there's the temporal dynamics that take place at relatively short time scales, involving individual decisions about things that are out there in the world, but relating those to long-term temporal dynamics, looking at what happens as people develop from expertise from becoming a novice.
Why don't we take your example of ornithologists, bird spotting, right? Okay, so because lots of kids start by doing this.
Mm-hmm. So my son being one, for example.
Okay, all right. Do you go with him?
I do. Okay, and I've learned a lot from just watching him. And
what are the things that you're looking for when you're watching the trajectory of a skill development in something like that? I mean, obviously, gets better at recognizing
things, but
I mean, what's going on?
Well, there's a classic finding that was actually first discovered by another member of the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center, Jim Tanaka, that experts can make a relatively subordinate level decision like that's a blue jay as rapidly as they can just say that's a bird. Now, that's probably not a very good example. Blue jays are things that everyone can recognize. But an expert can say that's a chipping sparrow as quickly as you or I would be able to say that's just a bird or a little brown job, which is what a lot of the birders call the little birds that most of us kind of ignore. So that's one example of the kind of changes that take place. There's this shift in the kind of automatic level of categorization that takes place as people develop expertise. They begin to see the world carved up into finer and finer distinctions as they develop expertise, making rapider and rapider decisions as they acquire this knowledge.
Now, you also work with, and we'll be having a conversation later with Isabelle Gauthier, who works on visual expertise. So this is one area, this is the area, primary area, I assume, where your paths cross and your interests intersect.
Right. But
you spend a lot of time on the modeling end of this, right?
Right.
Could you for a general audience, just say what the difference is and what's involved in modeling something?
Right. Well, maybe I can step back a little bit and talk some about how Isabelle and I first got to collaborating, and it happened in the context of deciding to team teach a class. This was actually before her and I started collaborating. We decided to teach a class together. Now, Isabelle comes from a tradition of vision science, which is involved in understanding visual perception, visual processing, and really the underlying mechanisms that take place from the eye to the cortical areas involved in vision. My background is more in how we develop perceptual knowledge about the world, how we categorize objects, know what things are, know the names of objects, make decisions about objects. Traditionally, those were considered to be pretty different domains in psychology. Mm-hmm. There was vision science, and there was kind of more traditional cognitive psychology. This was sensory processing, perception. This was cognition, memory, and learning. Isabel and I wrote a couple of papers where we, as a result of teaching this class and having to try to develop a shared vocabulary, where we really realized that over time, work in visual perception kind of started foundationally with the assumption that there's these built-in feature detectors that then get built up to higher level feature detectors, which ultimately are used to develop three-dimensional models of the world. Well, work by Isabel and her mentor at the time, Mike Tarr, who was also a member of the TDLC.
And it's just gone to Carnegie Mellon.
Yes, just gone to Carnegie Mellon, exactly. Work that they did and others had shown that visual experience doesn't involve these built-in kind of building blocks of perception, but is tuned by experience. That it's actually the experience that you have with objects in the world from particular angles, particular viewpoints, particular lighting conditions that are really the building blocks for perception. While we walk around the world thinking that we're developing these three-dimensional models, what we may actually have is lots of individual representations of objects from various viewpoints under various conditions, and it's the way the brain integrates that information that allows us to kind of see objects and recognize them from multiple perspectives. So that's what's been known as an image-based view of visual recognition. On the kind of conceptual side of things, early on there was a lot of work suggesting that our knowledge about objects in the world is based on things like abstract rules, prototypes. So your knowledge of a bird is based on some representation that's relatively abstract. So you can see right there kind of early on a divide between this really abstract knowledge you have of things in the world, and then there's perception, which just kind of develops a representation. Well, in the concept side of work in cognitive psychology, there began to be a lot of work suggesting that, well, in fact, our knowledge about what are seemingly abstract concepts is based on our particular experiences with individual examples of those concepts. So we don't store prototypes. We may use rules, but especially when you're an expert, you don't use the rules. They're not as readily available to you. But it's based on lots and lots of experiences, cases, examples, particular experiences you've had with those objects. And so that's just one example of a kind of a convergence that took place in two very, very different disciplines that didn't really communicate with one another, where there seems to be this more experiential-based idea of vision combined with a more experiential-based view of knowledge. And the result being that the line between perception and cognition is a really fuzzy one, that the same kinds of representations that support high-level vision may actually be supporting what had traditionally been called the knowledge that you have about the world around you.
Yeah, can I ask a quick question here? Suppose... you see an apple, you see another apple, you see another apple, you see another apple. Are you saying that eventually what you build up from these individual sightings, which are representations, is the representation gets shifted slightly, you end up with almost what you might think of as a Platonic ideal prototype of an apple?
That's a traditional view.
Right.
That you would, in fact, build up based on experience something which was a prototype or a Platonic ideal. This is an alternative, which says that, you know, what, and it kind of builds from kind of early ideas in cognitive science, where you take a, you know, kind of a computer analogy, you know, even going to the 60s and 70s, and computers are limited in memory, so you need to kind of condense information in a way that limits the amount of space that's used to store knowledge. So things like rules and things like Platonic ideals and prototypes are an efficient way of encoding information. These really suggest that what the visual system and what our knowledge is based on are deep, rich statistics about our experiences with the world. Now, at an extreme level, would be that every experience we have, whether it's with objects or individuals, gets stored as a unique example. Now, that's kind of an ideal, which is probably not what's happening in the visual system or anywhere in the brain. But in the continuum from... on the one hand, having very abstract representations, to the other hand, on the other end of the continuum, having unique experiences with every individual. It's probably more on this end of the continuum, based on experimental work that's been done. So you can give people experience with particular objects and show that actually the generalization, both in terms of categories but also in terms of visual perception, is relatively limited, suggesting that we're not very good at going beyond our particular experiences. But there's also models, both in the context of visual perception and in terms of object categorization, object knowledge, which suggests that you don't need to have this additional abstraction on top of a model that simply suggests that you remember the examples that you've seen before. When you see a new example, you compare it with those examples that you have stored someplace in your brain, and you use those to make a decision. Now, on the one hand, it kind of seems a bit odd that you would remember all of these examples, but several people, including one good example is Larry Barslew, who's a well-known cognitive scientist, you know, suggested that, in fact, there's great utility in storing these specific examples, because by making an abstraction, you're deciding a priori what's important for later on. Right? Somehow you need to be omniscient about what you're going to need later in a unique situation. If you have a learning system which instead keeps a lot of information, a lot of detailed information about your specific experiences and their outcomes and inferences that you might have made, you're able to more flexibly adapt to unique situations because of that rich body of knowledge that you have. So you can actually do abstractions on the fly rather than having to do abstractions ahead of time. Know which are going to be important later and dispense with the information that you think is irrelevant. Mm-hmm. We're not very good at making those decisions. And it actually requires a relatively complex system for trying to figure out what's going to be important later on, weighting that information. Now, some of that's probably done, but the work in perception and cognition has really suggested that you know, it's probably more parsimonious in terms of learning and also maybe more adaptive in terms of our ability to deal with future situations if we keep as much information as possible.
So your end is to work in the modeling area within that paradigm.
Right. So that's the way, one of the ways that I approach trying to understand what's happening as people perceive objects, learn about objects, and become experts. It's trying to develop models where the basic idea being that you take a hypothesis of what you think is happening inside of the brain and you instantiate it in terms of mathematics and computations.
Okay, now, in terms of your son and you, and you're out bird spotting, doing the ornithology, and again, let me just play devil's advocate here. As you're building up these repeated views of certain birds, they're not all blending into one. You're actually learning better distinctions.
Yes.
That sounds counterintuitive, doesn't it? From what you were earlier saying. From the older model.
Right. In what sense?
Well, instead of your sense of what constitutes this particular bird type. Instead of all the bird types blending into one and becoming rather more similar to each other, you're getting even finer grained distinctions between them by repeated sightings.
You're developing finer grained representations of individuals. But in fact, in the case, birding is actually a good example. One of the things I've learned, and I'm not a very good birder, so it's just by watching others, watching my son and watching people that have real skills, is that there's a tremendous amount of variability. You pick up a Peterson guide. Peterson's actually a pretty good guidebook for giving you birds and highlighting things in the way they actually look in the real world. But there's a tremendous amount of variability in terms of molt patterns as the season goes on, whether they're in breeding season or non-breeding season. There's times where the same individual will look very different if you go over the course of the calendar. So actually having these detailed representations of even a particular species is useful, because the platonic ideal for, say, an indigo bunting isn't going to do you very good for identifying that bird when it's not the breeding season, because it looks very different from what you might see in the guidebook. So, you know, that's just an example where having this detailed knowledge is really useful and critical, and it actually distinguishes the real expert from somebody who's just done a bit of studying in the books to kind of prepare for going and doing backyard bird counts and things, where or maybe you don't need to have that same level of skill.
One of the conversations we had earlier today with with Rene Marois, talking about attention and the way in which the brain's capacity for processing information, and how easy it is to how difficult it is to actually easily process different competing streams of sources of information. There's a reminder there, and he has in his lab, as you know, that hourglass which shows brain trying to be reduced into grains of sand. I think there's a general perception out there that we have these amazing computers on the end of our necks here, and don't have any sense of what their limits are. When you're talking about the kind of modeling that you do, when you're talking about perception, when you're talking about looking at birds and all this sort of stuff, how do those two things play against each other? The constraints on the one hand of the architecture and the sheer limits of neurons firing and so on, versus the amazing computational ability of the brain?
Well, I mean, there's one sense in which this idea that you have to develop rich representations of complex objects that you see in the world is maybe a way of solving one of those problems. Because when you're a novice, for example, when I see the birds that my son looks at, I see a beak, I see you know, certain very distinctive markings and certain colorings, and I can see that it has yellow legs and not black legs, and so I can see all those pieces, and then it's just I have to try to keep all those in mind. And then, you know, my son's looking at it and identifying all these things, and I'm trying to learn. I'm trying to look in the guidebook and trying to find these things, and I'm trying to keep this half dozen different individual features in mind in order to try to find the one. And then I forget, did it have yellow legs or did it have black legs? My son sees the bird as a whole. I mean, he sees that and sees it in its context as well. And he's a skilled birder, by no expert by any means. Real experts not only see the whole bird, but see it in its context and see it in its environment in a way that really gives them a boost. But that that may come about because they have developed these relatively complex representations that essentially say, look, you don't have to remember all the individual features because I've got a placeholder here in your brain that has the context in which these things appeared and has a kind of a bound representation of those objects in your domain of expertise. So therefore, essentially becomes an individual unit as opposed to half a dozen units that have to be kind of contained in memory at once. So in a sense, having those kind of detailed representations helps to solve some of that attentional limitations. Now, that comes at a cost. And a good example, I visited the Cornell lab. We're starting some collaborations with them because they're interested in actually what makes experts experts, because they have these tremendous citizen science projects where they have tens of thousands of people go out and actually do bird observations, and those become the critical data infrastructure for the basic research that they're doing. And I was talking with some of the experts there, and these are world-class experts. These are the best of the best. And they were talking about how they were in a context where somebody was playing, I think it was actually bird song, it wasn't visual identification, but the speakers were on the ground. And they were having real difficulty identifying these birds, and these were people that were really skilled. And they said then they realized what it was, and it was that the bird song was coming from the speaker sitting on the ground, but these were birds that they always heard up in the trees. And so these people had real skill in making these identifications, did them all the time. Expert birders rely on birdsong all the time. Yet simply because of the change in context, they found it really difficult until they kind of realized that that was the problem. So that's one you know, anecdote. I mean, there's been work that's been done, and this is one of the things that Isabel and I have been collaborating on, both experimentally and in terms of models. And it's another cost that comes from expertise. And it's that if you ask an expert to look at part of an object, and you construct the objects in such a way that the other half of the object, so imagine creating a composite bird. It's actually been done a lot with faces. So you take the top half of someone's face, the bottom half of somebody else's face, but you can do it with birds as well, and ask the person, look, ignore this bottom part. It's irrelevant, right? they can't. A novice can. A novice finds no difficulty in ignoring the irrelevant part. But because the experts have developed this kind of unitary, holistic representation, whatever that means, they can't kind of go back to what it was like to be a novice and say, look, I'm just going to identify. I'm just going to pay attention to the beak, right? Birders actually refer, they call this the jizz, that you just kind of get the impression. And it's very rapid. You get an impression of a bird as a whole. And you just kind of know what it is before you have even in silhouettes. You don't need to see the whole thing. You just know it based on its shape and also based on its motion and other cues. It's just there, and the whole thing kind of acts as a real gestalt for recognition.
It's really kind of distinguishing. So you've built up this entire representation.
Well, that's the idea, that it's very contextualized, very detailed. You know, it's not a snapshot, right? So I'm not suggesting that you have these snapshots.
It has...
It's multidimensional.
Multidimensional has must have emotional components as well.
I'd imagine, yeah, it wouldn't be a stretch.
You're building this thing. Right. So tell me about this Cornell project in a bit more detail here. What are we talking about in terms of? Because I know this is something we've talked about in terms of the going forward with the project.
Right. So the basic idea actually started by me simply approaching the lab to see if we could recruit some people to be in experiments. You know, we want to study expertise, need to find experts. Sometimes it's hard to recruit people. I've actually got contacts in the Nashville community for finding experts, given my son's birding interests. And it was actually through my son that we kind of got indirectly in touch with some people in the Cornell lab. And so we went up, actually my son and I went up and we visited to just talk with them, you know, so show my son the lab, but also maybe talk with them about experts. And as we started talking, I hadn't fully appreciated the importance of the work that people in the community do. That there's thousands of people participating in things like the Christmas bird count, which has been going on for years. There's something called the backyard bird count. There's other formal and informal bird counts that are done. And then there's people that just in response to their interest in their hobby will go out on weekends and keep tallies of the birds. And what the Cornell lab has done is develop this data infrastructure where people can go online, enter the day, the location, the time, and give detailed records. They saw 27 black vultures and 3 red-winged blackbirds and so on. And then this becomes part of a database that's used for basic birding research. I mean, one example that they told me about was there's an invasive species, I think from Europe, called the Eurasian collared dove. And they've been actually able to track over time, as this bird was initially introduced, how quickly it's been migrating through the U.S., Data like that's actually been used to try to test like virus and epidemiological models. It's also critical data for climate change research because they can look at changes in bird populations. And so it has a lot of really broad implications for kind of above and beyond even just birding work. And so they were interested in kind of two strands. One is understanding who the real experts are, coming up with ways of quantifying their expertise, and then as a side benefit for us, being able to look at how different things vary as people go from being certainly a novice to a backyard birder to somebody who's skilled and has many years of experience to someone who's now a professional ornithologist who's really the expert's expert, and look at what kind of changes not only take place kind of early in learning, but also what distinguishes somebody who's would be considered an expert to me, like my son, to somebody that he would turn to, right? So that somebody at the kind of top of their game in terms of expertise. And so that's one kind of component that they have interest in, is trying to characterize what makes somebody an expert. Because if they know that you're really the expert's expert, you enter data into their database and say, look, you know, we need to weight, you know, Roger's observations more heavily than maybe somebody else, right? They're going to be more valid kind of instruments out there. Essentially, they're using the citizen sciences as their scientific instruments out there in the field. And this could be a way of maybe calibrating those instruments as a way of of weighting their observations.
This leads me to two thoughts, which may be false leads or not, but see if they do anything for you. One is in terms of how does this translate into classrooms? We talk about brains are us. We talk about the science of educating. Is this sort of study of expertise, how does it translate into classrooms? Do you want to go there first? Or?
Sure. Well, I think in general, so I guess backing up. So, clearly most work looking at experts is going to be looking at adult learning, which is certainly important, right? Whether it's in medical domains, security domains, scientific domains.
That was my other part, legal domains.
Right.
How do judges get to be experienced,
right,
and so on?
Right.
And so,
that clearly has an important component, and the degree to which the basic research looking at expertise applies to these kind of workforce issues is certainly important. But we've learned through the work that's done by TDLC and the Perceptual Expertise Network that the work that's done looking at kind of adult expertise has impacts for thinking about what's happening in terms of development and certainly classroom settings. So there's work that's been done on face recognition work that's done on expertise that's informed our understanding of maybe how face recognition develops. So that's a relatively early kind of development, maybe preschool development. But you can take a model of what happens as adults develop expertise and apply it to see if maybe some of those same trajectories occur as children develop expertise in a domain like face recognition or in a domain like letter recognition, right? But it's easy also to imagine that there could also be other areas involved in schools where kids need to be able to make fine-grained identifications and certainly understanding how to more efficiently and effectively train adults to become experts could have impacts on how we think about educating children in certain domains as well.
So that's one area where you're overlapping with Isabel. There are other strands in your enterprise,
right? So there's a class of models that kind of inform the basic research that I do on understanding the temporal dynamics of perceptual expertise. And they kind of go like this. So the basic idea is that as we get sensory information from the world that's compared with our representations that we've developed about objects in the world, but ultimately, I'm interested in how people make perceptual decisions about those objects, what category they're in, whether they recognize them or not, whether they know that an object is even there, if they're categorizing it, what level are they categorizing. So there's a lot of perceptual decisions that we make about the objects around us. And a building block for these models is the idea that the incremental perceptual evidence that we have at any instant in time is insufficient to make an accurate decision. If I just took a snapshot within a few milliseconds of what my perceptual system was feeding me in terms of its interpretation of the objects that are out there and what kind of task I'm supposed to be doing, whether I'm trying to identify them or recognize them, any small little window of information that I get is going to be noisy, it's going to be invalid, it's going to lead me astray. So the basic idea is that this information needs to be accumulated. So I take a sample, and those samples are accumulated over time until I reach a threshold. I say, look, I have a sufficient amount of perceptual evidence in order to make a decision. Now I can adjust the threshold with which I say this is the amount of perceptual evidence I need in favor of this decision. And if the threshold is low, I'm going to make really rapid decisions, but I may make errors. Some situations demand that. Right, you have to respond quickly, and hopefully you're not going to make a mistake, but sometimes you do. Other times, I know that I need to make a very careful, deliberate decision to avoid error, so I can set the threshold high, accumulate more information, and make maybe slower responses that are less accurate. So these fall under these kinds of generic models are called accumulator models, stochastic accumulator models. There's particular examples called drift diffusion models or competitive accumulator models. There's a whole class of these models that have been studied for decades in psychology. And they really do a remarkable job of accounting for minute details of human performance. They tell you they can predict the errors that people make. They can predict the time of responses that people make, but they can also predict the variability of those responses. So not just that some responses are slower than others, but some responses are going to be more variable than others. Now, these models kind of inform the work that we do on human expertise, looking at the long-term changes that take place in learning. Right? So why do people speed up in various kinds of tasks as they develop expertise? They also inform our work that looks at the microstructure of individual decisions, right? So why are some decisions faster than others, and how can we unravel what's happening at various time points within a perceptual decision? But they also inform understanding what's happening in the brain as we make decisions. There's been work from our group and other groups that have used this class of models to really try to understand what's happening in neurons in monkeys that are performing tasks that are analogous to the kinds of tasks that we might ask people to do. Simplified versions, but they're, by analogy, they're very similar in spirit to what humans are doing. And we're using these models now that have provided outstanding accounts of human performance to account for the performance, so the time, the errors, the variability in responses of monkeys, but more importantly, to also explain what's happening in terms of the individual neurons in the brains of the monkeys making those decisions. The basic approach that we use is to take these models, see how well they account for the behavior of the monkeys, right? So that's kind of the first step, which is analogous to what we might do with people. So people are in an experiment, we collect data in terms of responses and the time to make those responses. And we can see how well competing models account for their behaviors. But then we can also look at the activity of these accumulators that we think are taking place inside of the brain and actually compare the dynamics in the model. So we have this unit in the model, which is accumulating information over time. It has a certain temporal dynamic. We can measure the temporal dynamic of those abstract computational entities and compare them to measures that are taken of neurons doing the task at the same time. And we can provide actually a remarkable account predicting, based on these abstract models, what's going to happen in the brains of monkeys making these decisions, accounting for very precise temporal dynamics of the neurons as they change over time.
Is it possible to come up with a better sense of how accurate people are if they're given longer or shorter time in which to make decisions? I mean, does having longer time to make a decision improve it, or are the snaps? You often hear that very instant decisions are the best, you know.
Right. It does depend on the situation. So, all else being equal, having more time will generally lead to better decisions. Now, that said, as more time goes on, you can get competing information, you can get irrelevant information, and especially if that information is salient or you ascribe importance to it, it can actually lead you astray. So there's lots of experiments that have been done showing that you can actually get not just changes in accuracy as you force people to make faster, slow responses, but you can get qualitatively different decisions. You'll choose this response under a rapid decision and choose an alternative response under a more deliberate decision.
When we talk about education at this point, there's a great deal of talk about the fact that it's broken is a word you'll often hear. And the most recent articles that one looks at, there's a theme here. Here's a cover of Newsweek from just a couple of weeks ago. We must fire bad teachers. Here's another one from the New York Times magazine, Building a Better Teacher. The Atlantic, almost the same month, What Makes a Great Teacher. The focus, you see a pattern here, is on what's going on with the teachers. I would have thought that the sort of stuff that you're talking about here applies equally well to how to build a better student, how to build a better learner. And do you have any sense, not pushing you into grand generalities here, but from what you know, what are the indications of some things that help make better learners?
Well, there's a difference between making a better learner and creating a better learning situation or learning environment. So, so I guess the question is whether there are things that can be done to make learning more effective, more efficient, promote retention. And that's where, I think some of the work that's done by TDLC can be useful in terms of looking at the importance of things like feedback, the importance of understanding the timing of information. When is it useful to repeat information? Is it better to repeat things immediately? Is it better to repeat things after a delay? If after a delay, how much of a delay? I think there's things that could be condensed into digestible suggestions for what makes for more effective learning in terms of changing aspects of the learning environment. But obviously I think the initial question was what makes a better learner, or how do you make a better learner? And that's,
it's sort of a generic thing. You can interpret it. So the recent science paper as well last year from Andy Meltzoff, Pat Kuhl, Javier Mavey, and Terry Sanofsky, Foundations for New Science of Learning. Understanding some of the underpinnings of the enterprise of the process, obviously is important. So that's really what I was talking about. I'm not suggesting that we should genetically engineer better learners.
Right.
So, but it was looking at it from the other end of the. Other end of the spectrum, which is instead of the media's insistence on building better teachers, how do you create the conditions in which learning is more effective?
I mean, thinking about real world education scares me because it's so unconstrained. As an experimental psychologist, right? I want to impose controls to be able to understand what's going on. And my wife's actually a professor in education, so hearing the kinds of challenges that she has in trying to teach people at Vanderbilt, to try to teach people to become teachers, try to teach students to become teachers is a real formidable challenge, especially in these very complicated environments.
But doesn't your stuff have to go into the real world?
Sure, it does. It needs to make contact. I think there's multiple routes to that, right? One is that the kind of slow route where it gets gradually, assimilated into the way that people think about learning. The work my wife does is a good example. She looks at the psychological literature on conceptual change and conceptual development to inform teachers about this is a way maybe you should think about the challenges that young children face, because there's been basic research done, for example, in getting kids to conceptualize the day-night cycle. Some of this is, work that's been done over the last 10 or 15 years, but, really trying to do experimental work that says, look, what are the kinds of conceptual structures that children form? They're very different from the kinds of knowledge that we have. And so as a teacher, you need to understand the vast individual differences that children have based on their experiences and their ways of thinking about the world. And how do you get them to go from these very odd models where they think that the world is flat and the earth goes past the sun, past on the other edge of this flat earth, and and they just have no relationship to reality, and get them to the kind of model that a teacher wants to adopt. So I think that's one route, which is getting to, that this work ends up informing teacher educators and getting them to teach future teachers. It's more of a challenge to teach existing teachers, right? You need to have continuing education, and someone has to distill the knowledge in a way that makes it have an impact and gets them to really think about ways that they might change their teaching. I think teachers are, my dad was a teacher, and he was always pretty skeptical when somebody came along and had a new suggestion, because the suggestion that somebody had 5 years ago would be different from the suggestion someone had 5 years later. And so I think there needs to be the right time and place for making these suggestions. And they need to be proven, they need to be kind of tested and shown that these results are effective. So I think there needs to be a bit of caution in terms of the timeline for making these impacts.
I was just going to say,
there's different routes to translation. I mean, some of the work we want to do with the Cornell Lab actually uses these individuals, some of which could well be children interested in birding as part of a science curriculum, to get them to enhance their identification skills. Now, it's very circumscribed, right? So it's identifying unique species of birds, right? And how do you train somebody to be better, be more skilled, so retain the knowledge?
Question is in fact something like that part of a routine curriculum anywhere, birding?
That's a good question. I don't know if it is. I mean, I think it's an auxiliary part of curriculum. I don't think it's certainly not a skill that's part of any standardized test, but I think it's an example where it's something that could be and probably is part of many science curricula. And the exposure that a child has, so you learn to make these bird identifications, now you go out into a park or to a nature preserve, and you're better able to recognize the things around you, gives them a better appreciation for the diversity of the wildlife, and may change their thoughts about issues.
I suppose what I was asking there, underpinnings of what I was asking there was that sometimes we hope that understanding the neuroscience better and informing a science of learning, you discover that some of the things that perhaps have been done without that knowledge, like if you're cutting back on a budget, you stop the PE or stop the music.
Right.
The things that sound like luxuries or fripperies, in fact, are foundational learning tools themselves. So that I was making the point, I suppose, that if somebody had suggested, well, let's put birding into the curriculum, people might say, kidding, you should do that in the spare time. But in fact, it could well be an extremely valuable piece of the science of learning.
Sure. It could be. It could well be. Mm-hmm.
So I think finding these things out is just enormously important. Mm-hmm. How did you get into this business in the first place? You said your dad was a teacher, is that?
Yeah.
Did you decide, therefore, that an academic career was in the cards for you? Or what?
No, I was going to be an engineer. I went to Carnegie Mellon to be an engineer. And I decided that building electric circuits was not a whole lot of fun. Was interested in artificial intelligence. Actually, as an undergraduate, I worked in the computer vision lab at Carnegie Mellon in a robotics institute. And we were, at that time, developing these computer robots that would move around campus and move around the park that was next to Carnegie Mellon. Now they drive on roads and they're, out. Completely autonomous vehicles. And
who was there? Who was in the department?
This was Takeo Kanade, who's a well-known vision scientist.
Of course.
And I had a really unique experience. So I was an undergrad in engineering, switched to cognitive science. I had a friend, never heard of cognitive science before. A friend said, hey, there's this thing called cognitive science. It kind of combines a little bit of AI with some of the psychology stuff. I wouldn't have ever thought of being a psychologist ever. Never took a psychology course, was never interested in taking a psychology course. Jay McClellan, who's a member of the executive committee of the TDLC, was a professor at Carnegie Mellon, taught a course in parallel distributed processing. It was in 1986, which is when the PDP books first came out. Jonathan Cohen, who's well known in the field, was a student in the class. Him and Kevin Dunbar, their class project was creating what ultimately became the Stroop model, which is really well known, PDP model that came out in the early 1990s. Took a course with Martha Farah, some people may have heard of. She was, I think, assistant professor and associate professor. And she taught a course in the cognitive neuropsychology of vision. So at this time, she was doing imagery research. She had been, I guess, a Coslin student, was basically doing cognitive psychology. Said, you know, I really want to learn something about the cognitive neuropsychology of vision because I think it's important for understanding imagery and other things. And so she was teaching this course as an informed novice, but certainly not the expert that she became. And, you know, a few years later, published her well-known book on prosopagnosia and is now obviously a leading expert in the field. Took a course with Herb Simon on thinking, took a course with John Anderson where it was an introduction to cognitive psychology that you had to take a Lisp programming course on the side. So this was my undergraduate experience, taking these classes where many of them were actually graduate courses. Didn't realize at the time what a kind of unbelievable experience. And when, you know, where I was at the time, you know, this confluence of, you know, Herb Simon on the one hand saying, you know, nothing interesting happens in less than 200 milliseconds. And then 2 hours later, being Jay McClellan's class saying nothing interesting happens in, you know, nothing happens in more than 200 milliseconds, whatever, that I was trying to say. And so it was unique. And then, you know, took a couple of years off and decided I really wanted to go back to graduate school and got my, you know, doing modeling. That was kind of the underpinning of what I wanted to do and kind of deciding between various kinds of approaches and ended up in Indiana with Rob Nosofsky doing modeling of human cognition, especially category learning and perceptual categorization.
Hmm. So did you ever consider doing anything else? Anything else you'd ever considered doing instead of being a scientist or an engineer?
No, I think once I got it in my head, you know, that's...
But why were you there in the first place? I mean, was this...
Carnegie Mellon?
Yeah, what was
that's
the influence?
A great engineering school. I mean, that was what attracted me.
But
was
to be an engineer at all? Why?
Because it was what my guidance counselors told me I should do. I was good in math. I was good in science. So I should be an engineer. It's what my dad told me. He said, because you make good money. Yeah. You know, I didn't put a whole lot of thought. My high school was not the kind of place that was, you know, real nurturing. I mean, most of the people ended up not even going to college. It was about 10 or 15 of us that went on to a four-year college. Most went to two-year colleges, went to the military, got a job, or got married. I mean, that was really the route that a lot of people took. So it was kind of unique to go on and do that.
You mentioned the Stroop test. I mean, Isabel was mentioning to me that isn't over at the School of Education there the original Stroop test?
Yeah, Stroop
test
got his PhD at Peabody. So it was a separate college at the time, but it's all part of Vanderbilt. So the original dissertation and the Stroop cards are hanging up.
Just give me some sense of the importance of timing, understanding timing in this whole science of learning.
Well, I think there's a lot of dimensions that are important. Right, I wouldn't want to prioritize. This is the only dimension that's important. But I think it's important to bring together people focused on what is really a critical aspect of learning, which is looking at the time and timing and understanding how those dynamics change with learning is really a fundamental aspect. I mean, it impacts the measures that you make about learning, right? So one of the most salient things that change is that people get faster and they're more efficient. So understanding those kind of changes that take place neurally, understanding the underlying neural changes that take place, whether it means developing more efficient representations, whether it means changing pathways in the brain to allow information to go from one brain area to another brain area more quickly and more efficiently with less noise. So that's the one side, looking at the dynamics of behavior, but then also understanding what it is about how you time information that's presented, feedback that's given to optimize learning. There's a lot of things that are under a teacher's control that we understand bits and pieces of, but I think it's bringing all of those together in a center like this, where you have people interested in different components, right? So things about the world, things that are internal to the organism. They obviously interact in critical ways, looking at things from a behavioral perspective, but also from a neural perspective. To understand all of these components is really critical. It's the kind of thing that can only be done in a center. You need people from multiple disciplines and multiple perspectives to really understand this kind of one fundamental component of learning, which really has not received attention. It's an important component of lots of other areas of neuroscience, of cognitive science, of cognitive neuroscience, but bringing it all together, I think, is really really what's unique, and I think what's important to try to really make important changes in understanding how people learn.
The importance of education is, you know, is pretty evident. I mean, the president's very concerned about this. When he came into office in his inaugural speech, that he said that he was going to restore science to its rightful place. I mean, he didn't give any coordinates for what that is.
Right.
But plainly, the administration is concerned about science. What do you think is the rightful place of science in this society, given the work you do in education and so on?
Well, let me answer it this way. Going to be probably more specific than you want me to. I think one of the things that is really clear to me is that behavioral science needs to have support. Over the years, there had been a lot of shift of emphasis to supporting more and more neuroscience and cognitive neuroscience research, which I think is essential. There's no question about that. The work that I do is informed by neuroscience. It interfaces with neuroscience. I do cognitive neuroscience research. I collaborate with people that do functional brain imaging and neurophysiology. But there's been an underemphasis on basic behavioral work that had been reflected for a long time in NIH priorities. Sometimes it's been reflected in NSF funding. And I think especially given a focus on thinking about ways of translating the work we do most immediately to whether it's classrooms or workplace issues or homeland security issues, it's really critical to continue the foundations of work that we've done understanding and manipulating behavior. So doing experiments that really understand why people make errors, when they make errors, why they're slow, when they're slow, and how to influence those through learning. How to change the way that people are presented information and presented feedback in order to speed up learning, enhance generalization, and improve retention of information. This is impacts for not only schools, but also developing training programs for either putting people into new careers or enhancing the expertise of people in existing careers. It also has important clinical implications. I mean, there's a lot of evidence showing that it's kind of cognitive behavior therapies that really are produce the most long-lasting changes above and beyond drug therapies for treatments of various disorders. So I think I'm hoping that there's going to be a continued recognition of the importance of that kind of work, whether it's from NSF or from NIH. And I think our center certainly embodies that there's importance for understanding behavior, importance for understanding things at a more computational, abstract level, but relating all of those levels together, that the answers aren't solely going to be found by looking at basic neuroscience. They're not going to be solely found by looking at behavior, but you really need to look at multiple levels of analysis and really integrate all of those. And so my hope is that going forward is something which is going to have priority, because I think ultimately it's a lot of the behavioral work which is probably going to have the most short time scale in terms of having impacts. And then it's when we understand the underlying neuroscience that really provides the foundation that I think sometimes helps justify why these are better interventions than others, because I think people latch on to understanding things from a biological perspective, and that can make an argument more convincing than simply showing that there's experimental or scientific evidence to support a particular way of doing something over a competing alternative.
Given the way in which the TDLC is set up and the interdisciplinary nature of all of this, all the various groups working together, I mean, are you basically optimistic this is going to actually lead to solid foundations for new science of learning?
I think it already has. I mean, we're just the amount of progress that we've made, even just in a few years, is pretty tremendous. Just seeing the new collaborations, which are just one metric for gauging whether something new is happening, but also, you know, I think we're really seeing interconnections between basic behavioral work, neuroscience work, cognitive neuroscience work. Really seeing these kind of points of connection where explanations that might be used to understand behavior are actually being used to understand neurophysiology and explain changes in functional brain imaging. I mean, we're really at a cool kind of crossroads now where when I was going through graduate school, people were cognitive scientists and they were neuroscientists, and they didn't talk to one another. Right. And, you know, cognitive neuroscience certainly has brought that together. But now I think it's not just at the level of using brain imaging, but it's that combined with theories that really bridge basic neuroscience and cognitive science, paradigms that can be done with humans and monkeys and also computer models, that where you really see a lot of theoretical convergence. I mean, we're really starting to understand the tough problems about how people make decisions and represent information and really the building blocks of learning. I mean, there's a lot of work still that remains to be done, but I think the work that I see in the center and elsewhere is really exciting, seeing how all of this stuff is coming together. It's not that work and behavior is going in this direction and modeling is going this direction and neuroscience is off in a different direction. The work seems to be coming together. There really seems to be a confluence of theory and experiment which really kind of support one another and provide converging evidence for thinking about all sorts of different facets of learning.
Right. Tom Palmieri, thanks very much.